Well, I had in mind a talk which I'll probably give, but just before coming in to sit down, Steve mentioned to me about the very distressing situation in the Near East with the Palestinians and the Israelis, and he asked me if we would do a loving kindness meditation for the situation, and for my various reasons, my own reasons perhaps, I want to devote any time during the sitting for that, but I was very moved. I've been very moved by the whole situation, reading about it, but also feeling Steve's concern as he brought it up. And so I'm sitting here kind of with, you know, with these two things. Can you hear okay? Is it working? Is that working anymore? You can't hear very well? Maybe I need to bring it closer? So that works better now? Should I repeat what I said? Yeah. So I have these two currents of concern going through me right now. One is the topic of the talk I was going to give, which maybe can be tied into the second concern, which is what Steve brought up. And I think for some people here in this room, the situation in Israel and Palestine is probably quite distressing. And Steve asked if we could do some loving kindness for the situation, and I just thought just bringing it up, and if some of you want to talk about your feelings, maybe Steve or some feelings about it, it might be nice to hear about that a little bit, and then maybe that could be tied into the talk. You want to say anything, Steve?
Well, there was an article I was reading this morning in the paper where. Talking about the hatred, well, it's obvious the hatred Palestinians feel for Israelis, but there's also talking about the hatred Israelis feel for Palestinians, and not only people who are on the right in Israel, but now people on the left, a lot of deep resentments that have always been there for years and years. And something I always thought about is, you know, everybody's going around for the last 10 years trying to develop a peace plan until people come to terms with that, as this week there's a lot of bright hope with the people of Yugoslavia coming, they may be starting to come to terms with that. Until people get rid of their hatred and animosity for each other, it can never be real peace. That's why I spoke to Gil, is not looking for solutions, but that each side come to terms with their hatred, and if they can give up their hatred, then the peace will naturally flow after that.
Please.
Yes, that's certainly a bit of interest to me in that my wife is Israeli and my stepson went back to Israel last week. And I find that my reaction to it is that I'm not Israeli, I'm not Palestinian. I was thinking of it. But I find myself, it's very difficult now. React in these kind of situations, and to try to be observant and neutral. And there's so much propaganda, there's so much attempt to persuade people to think certain things, and a lot of it seems to be quite destructive in terms of influencing our opinion on either side. And there's so much effort made, it seems like, to create. I think it's helpful to be aware of the fact that there is a lot of effort being made to persuade people to think one way or the other. And a lot of the effort is not in the best interest of either side. And that's the unfortunate thing. It seems like people when one tries to be helpful by being supported to one side or the other, it seems like it doesn't contribute very much. So my sense is that it's very difficult, it's very complicated. So there's so much effort put into all of this, trying to explain to people, trying to understand, and it's really complicated. I live with, like I said, my wife is Israeli, most of the people out there, many of the people I
Thank you. Yeah.
So, for what it's worth, I would mention that here today, near the very end of the prayer, Tesh Shabbat, for those people who are Jewish background, that tomorrow, tonight is the Kumazin. Sundown tomorrow is the Day of Atonement. And during this period, Tesh Shabbat means returning to our higher selves, what it means. And this is a time for, I think, for each individual to think about healing. And one of the traditions in this healing is the Tikkun Olam, the healing of the pairing of the world at large. It seems to me incredibly funny that this conflict and the death take place during this very period. I have no advice for anyone, but just a mindfulness that around the world, this is a time for repair.
Sometimes Yom Kippur is called the Day of At-One-Ment as well as the Day of Atonement, which is a clever but meaningful wordplay, which always reminds me of interbeing, which is the core in some ways of this problem. The number of overlaps in days of religious importance and family lineages is more than coincidental, in my opinion, that 3,800 years ago, Abraham was not only the father of Isaac, Jew, but an Ishmael, a Muslim, and that this is in many ways the mother of all family feuds, and that in 1982, the man who Israeli general who walked into the holy site 2 weeks ago to begin this, Sharon, slaughtered many Palestinians in the Shatil Lebanese camp and chose to, 2 weeks ago, remind Palestinians of that in your eye way. But the Yom Kippur War was started 27 years ago on the most holy day by Arabs to remind Sharon that he had in fact committed this atrocity on Rosh Hashanah 28 years ago. 18 years ago. Three weeks ago, probably the most prominent Palestinian in the Bay Area in terms of dialogue and peace died suddenly while meeting at Grace Cathedral with a group of Jews and Palestinians trying to reach peace on a personal level, who understood that governments can do only so much in the face of people-to-people hatred. And he died on the podium as he was speaking. And the people-to-people contact was put to a real test. I was, with some trepidation, ordered to honor this good man and good friend, went to his family's house entered two rooms of people dressed in black, one all mustachioed Palestinian man, and one all black veiled Palestinian women. And I felt like I, a Jew, stood out like a sore thumb, and I wanted to run, but I didn't. And after a bit of puzzlement, I was actually incorporated into that group. People understood that I was trying to make a gesture of peace. And I was fed and I was shepherded for the rest of the evening, although I knew no one was the only Jew there. In many ways, for me, the best of a mindfulness practice is absolutely no different from the best of what other wise people have said through the ages. But for me, a daily practice, given my thick-headedness, is necessary because when I have one day of atonement, year, at the best, within 3 weeks, write speeches down the drain. And gossip is back. So in 55 years, that's my all-time record. Usually, I don't get out of the service without So it all ties together, and this is just one example of two sets of brothers and sisters going at it. But I have no doubt that if we delve into our tradition, we can find the same thing going on.
In terms of dates and coincidences, tomorrow is not only a Day of Atonement, but also in America, the Columbus Day, which for some people, they prefer to be called Genocide Day.
It's also Canadian
This is strong talk. It'd be nice maybe if other people have feelings hearing all this, if you would speak your reflections or your concerns or just your feelings, what it's like to hear this. And when I was studying Zen many years ago. The Zen teacher I studied with said that he talked a little bit about this is, I guess, in the time of people protesting for nuclear disarmament and various things, and he talked about nonviolence and engaged Buddhism, and he said that that Gandhi's contribution to Buddhism, as he called it, was Buddhism emphasizes the importance of sitting, being mindful, sitting, composing oneself, settling oneself on oneself, facing oneself deeply, maybe healing the divisions that exists within ourselves, and that so in the kind of the symbolic way of talking about that is to talk about sitting. So Buddhism emphasizes sitting. And that Gandhi's contribution to Buddhism was that he said that it matters where you choose to sit. So if you choose to sit in the privacy of your own comfortable home, perhaps, has a very different effect than if you choose to sit on the railroad tracks of going into, and you know, some place where they're building nuclear weapons. Or if you sit, on the border of the Gaza Strip in Israel or something. It matters, I think, where we put ourselves. And there's many ways of putting ourselves. One is physically in places, but also is to give ourselves some time to listen and hear about some of the things going on in the world. Many people come to a Sunday morning program where there's going to be Dharma, and maybe what they want is they want to be inspired. They want to be able to leave and feel really inspired and uplifted by it. But if that's just the only thing that happens in a Dharma setting, then we haven't learned much about the necessity of sitting ourselves in the midst of the world suffering and including that as part of what we are mindful of. If our mindfulness is only about our own well-being, then I don't think it's going to be very, you know, realistic. So I feel very welcoming that these kinds of issues get brought up today. Maybe we won't leave uplifted, but maybe we leave in a different way. It's said in Buddhism that compassion is one of the primary motivations for spiritual practice, and that compassion takes gives birth to two forms of motivation, and both of them it's very important to understand both of them. One is the motivation the compassionate motivation to do something about that, to go out in the world and help, or help a neighbor in distress or whatever. And the other is to sometimes we can't do that. Sometimes it doesn't make sense to do that. Sometimes our individual actions is not going to help maybe necessarily what goes on in Palestine, or what's going on in Chechnya, or what's going on in Indonesia, or what's going on. I mean, the litany of countries where there's problems is huge. And rather we can see those things and feel those things and be affected by them, and then in being affected by them, feel motivated to at least work on ourselves, to clarify ourselves, to make ourselves someone who doesn't hate, to make ourselves someone who's healed of their divisions within themselves. And these two sources of motivations, I think, are very important. When we can act, then it's very important to feel like you're following through. And when we can't act directly in a situation, then at least we feel like, we don't feel like it's hopeless, at least we feel that there's something we can, some direction we can put that energy, and that energy can go into our deepening our practice, becoming more peaceful ourselves. So to sit, it matters where we sit. And so we sit in the world that has the kind of things we're talking about today. So what is it like for some of you to, perhaps some of you have been successful at not reading the papers or not paying attention to those things. And some of you, it's all too familiar. Some of you, it's happening in your own backyards. you know, it's and probably all of us have some backyard where something is happening. I'm really impressed by how few people in the world are not in some way deeply affected by some either personal or cultural tragedy, either through themselves directly or through their relatives or their family or going back a few generations. And so we are such people. And one of the sources of suffering is to ignore our suffering. And sometimes it's very important, as you know, as Gandhi's contribution to Buddhism implies, that it matters where we sit. It matters that we take time to sit in the midst of the suffering and recognize it and have a place for it, and not just simply turn away from it or use spirituality in a kind of narcissistic way to kind of help us feel better and self, you know, improve ourselves, feel more comfortable ourselves, while the rest of the world goes untouched. So who wants to speak now? Please. I don't have a formulaic answer to that. I think that's it's a matter of each person reflecting for themselves, in a sense. It's possible not to see them as being so separate from each other. Hopefully, if we're engaged in some kind of work in the world, we can also feel or just know that it, or bring our mindfulness practice to bear also on how we function or how we respond or react to that social action. So that a very personal purification is going on in the context of doing the work. But we have lots of examples of people who maybe weren't ready personally to do social work, and they just go out and to create more harm out of their ignorance, and because their motivations are maybe quite biased. So maybe that, you know, those people, it's better they will go off and do some kind of personal work first and really clarify their motivations before they do the kind of more social work. So hopefully we have the wisdom, if we pay attention, to know what we need to do and where the balance is. But there's another way of looking at this, in a sense, perhaps, is we respond to what comes our way. And today Steve came with this issue about Israel and Palestine, and I felt that it had a lot of power for him, and it has a lot of power for me as I read the paper and what's going on there, and so I felt somehow that I didn't want to ignore it. I felt, and so it, like this, there was this particular suffering showed up, and so the response was not to turn away from it, but give it some space, give it some time. And I felt it was very important to give it some time in this group. I felt a little bit awkward to do so because, you know, it's not exactly an uplifting Sunday morning. But I feel it's very real, and if something very real like this shows up in the midst of us, I think it's very important to take the time to be there for it and not to kind of ignore it. And for me, sitting here with that, I mean, that it came my way. It came our way. It showed up in the middle of us here. And so for me, it's you know, since this is what's happening, I don't see a difference between the social outreach kind of approach and the personal approach. It's all happening right here for me as we're sitting here talking about it. Yeah, we don't know what's going to happen. I mean, it's possible that because of the tremendous suffering in there in that part of the world, that only because sometimes only because of tremendous suffering and tension can some actually new solution arise. My dream is that for years now has been that I have this dream that it's the women of that part of the world who are going to make a difference, not the men. And my dream has been that the Palestinian women and the Israeli women, the mothers of dead children, and you know, that they all put on white clothes and make some large, you know, action. You know, they march towards Jerusalem or something, and you have hundreds of thousands of women marching with their children, saying, "This is, you know, we've done this enough." You know. There has to be a stop to it. The men have tried to work it out for 50 years now, or 2,000 years, or whatever. And you know, sooner or later, we have to declare that they failed. And let's do it ourselves now, a different way. And you know, it's maybe utopian kind of thinking, but you know, maybe sometimes when things get really bad, they can turn. And sometimes things get really bad, and then they get worse. We don't know. So. I don't know what the lesson exactly here is, except that it's very important to always stay open to new possibilities. But new possibilities is they could also be worse, and they could be better. But some openness, some open possibilities, some sense of unknown, not to be fixed. So I think it's very helpful, because what you see is when people are polarized, they tend not to see the other person as someone who has open possibilities. They see the other as someone who has, you know, only through their bias. And so you can't, you know, the other person is not capable then of changing. When I was in Israel some years ago, to be fair, I should say probably a story on both sides, but because I believe you can find it in both sides, but I was visiting the Jewish parts of Israel, and I went into an Israeli tourist office to ask about visiting the Palestinian refugee camps in the West Bank or in Gaza Strip, and because I wanted to see that part of Israel, that part of the world, and I didn't want to kind of just live in this more. It was kind of like being in Israel was a little bit surrealistic, because I had very little, you know, everything was so comfortable and so sanitary, or sorry, sanitized or something, in terms of everything I've read for years and years, you know, with the difficulties in the newspapers. And to be there is like that was happening on a different planet, going around some of the neighborhoods I was going in. So there, I'll be nice to go visit some of these camps and Palestinians. So I thought you'd go into the tourist agency, you know, and ask, you know, how does this get arranged? And maybe that was stupid, but anyway, the response from the woman behind the counter was, why would you want to go see those dogs? And to hear someone talk about the Palestinians as dogs, especially someone in a government agency, who was a tourist agency, I mean, that just stunned me. So, and that's some example of someone, you know, you hold someone else in a fixed view. And if someone is dogs, then maybe you can't really expect any change. So maybe so, maybe not, you know, implies you have to be open to the other person as capable of changing. And if they're capable of changing, then they can be changed for the better, though we never know if it will. Yes, please.
A long lifetime ago, a colorful character named Emma Goldman once told people that our motto should not be to forgive each other, but rather to understand each other.
Beautiful.
I hear all these stories this morning and I'm really reminded how that for me compassion is a moment-to-moment awakening. It's a present felt experience. And I'm often aware too of how my perceptions or my tendency to give meaning to things sometimes blocks my capacity to feel compassion for what I witness. And so for me, it's struggling for that balance to understand both sides and yet to know that right now what's called for is compassion. Not second guessing, not attributing meaning, but just compassion. Because I know there's division, and I know that needs healing, and compassion is what's called for.
There was someone I read some years ago whose approach to world peace, maybe some of you know it better than I, the story. Maybe it was a movement of people who did this. But they'd go around to different trouble spots in the world, and they would go with a clipboard or something, or a tape recorder, and they would say, they just show up and stop kind of so-called ordinary citizens on the streets and say, would you be willing to tell me about your suffering or your distress or your difficulties? And I'm an American or something. I just like to hear what it's like for you. And to have an American going to these countries, because America, you know, is kind of like, people look up to it in many ways, and it's a great power. And the theory, I guess, was that to simply go and listen, to go there and know that, to have them feel like someone really cared and was listening, that in itself was significant. And it wasn't a matter of simply going there and offering solutions, but just going there and willing to listen to what was going on.
It's called, that there was one of the components is called the Compassionate Listening Project. And those words, I think, are the phrase compassionate listening. That's the primary context.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So I think it's part of it.
Please.
Think about the Olympics and the point that the Olympics is kind of bringing all nationalities and countries together in an athletic environment to, in a way, to create a kind of sense of peace and working together. And even when they're mad, so they come with that intent. And there's always problems that seem to revolve around the Olympics and politics that's gotten involved. And even when your intent is that, it seems so to be such a challenge to bring different ideologies and countries
to share a little bit.
family is that I was a Peace Corps volunteer in India in 71 and 72, and in 73 I went to Israel with my kibbutz, and I met this person and this woman, and we had fallen in love with them in 73. And I was going to go back. I'd been out of the States, I come from the Midwest, and I came back to the Midwest to visit my family before I was going to go back to Israel. But the war broke out in 1973, the Yom Kippur War, and my girlfriend had gone to the military. So we rode, and it was difficult for us because she couldn't get out of the military unless something happened, like if she would get married. But her parents wouldn't accept our relationship because I was Nigerian and she was Israeli and Jewish, and certainly the sense of nationalism was also much stronger at that time because of the war. So we wrote for months and months and tried to figure out how we would get back together. Well, it got to the point where we both had to accept that the fact that she was Israeli and I was an American, and that she was Jewish and I was not, and that the parents were opposed to the situation, we kind of let go of our dream. And so years passed by, and it was about 22 years had gone by, and this was about 4 years ago. And I had been in a long marriage and was going through a divorce. Afterwards, I decided, many years I had thought about writing to her and seeing, you know, what was going on in her life, and I had never really forgotten about her. And I really didn't see that there was a point in doing it up until then, so I sent a letter to Israel, to the kibbutz where I met her about 4 years ago, and she didn't live there anymore. But someone who lived in the kibbutz took the letter to her, and she was wrote back and said she had tried to find me over the years that we were apart, and that she couldn't find anyone. But she did find someone who knew my mother and found my mother, but my mother wouldn't give any information back because I was married at the time. So this is what I found out, you know, 4 years ago after I finally reached her. So she asked if she could come to see me, and so I said it would be okay. So she came to the States about 4 years ago to see me. And so now it's been 22 years since we last saw each other. I was in Israel. And it was very clear after we were together about 10 minutes that nothing had really changed for us in all the years that we were apart. So we worked out a way over the last couple of years so that she could end up here. What happened was she ended up moving here a couple of years ago with your children, and I moved out here last October, and her and I were married in October, and now I live in Silicon Valley in Sunnyvale, and she's just a couple of blocks away from her children and their father. And so that's how I ended up here a year ago. It was all connected to the fact that I had been in Israel 20 years ago. So it is interesting how things work out sometimes and how things come around and how sometimes things that were maybe meant to be tend to get there. But that's a lot of patience. Anyway, we were patient, and some things are quite good now. And last night I was sitting with her, his younger daughter, who was 20. We were talking about the situation, about what's going on there. And what's so complicated, of course, is that I even hear from her daughter the sense of compassion and the concern she has for the Palestinian people. She's talking about the suffering that they're going through and how she wishes things to be different for them. So it's beyond my comprehension in some ways to see that there's this concern from the same people that live there that still have to understand the situation. So anyway, so I'm not real sure why I told that story, but I find it's kind of relative to just the fact that things tend to work out sometimes.
Well, I thank you all, and I encourage you all to remember that sitting is very important, but where you sit is also very important, meaning that means various things, but when the world comes your way, as it always does, don't turn away from it, as we did today. Just sit, and be willing to listen. And if your mindfulness practice doesn't allow you to stay present and listen to what's actually going on, then you should probably do something different. So thank you for this morning, and I wish you all well.